brings us to the final chapter of the unit, which is about membrane structure and function. And here I'm talking once again about microscopic membranes. So plasma membrane, or any membrane that makes up membrane-bounded organelles, is the macroscopic membrane. But specifically in this chapter, we're focusing on the plasma membrane, which really defines every cell. And this should be review at this point, because we've already talked about this, but the reason that a plasma membrane exists is because phospholipids in the presence of water will automatically form a bilayer, which in three dimensions will be spherical. That's a very cell-like structure. And they do this without any life. They do this simply because the tails of the phospholipids, being made of fatty acids, which are almost entirely carbon and hydrogen, are nonpolar, right? Carbon and hydrogen have more or less equal electronegativities. Therefore, carbon-hydrogen bonds are nonpolar. Therefore, the tails are nonpolar. They do not want to be around polar things like water. They want to be around other nonpolar things. Well, if you form this bilayer, that's a way of achieving the situation in which the tails are only with other tails, not with water. They're not around the inside water or the exterior water. The heads are, but the heads want to be around the water because the heads are polar, since they contain the phosphate group. And all of this happens automatically simply because of the fact that each individual phospholipid is an example of a molecule that is polar on one part and nonpolar on the other part. What is the adjective that we use to describe such molecules? Meaning partly polar and partly nonpolar in the same molecule? Amphipathic. It is unwise to wait until right before the test. If you do that, you should expect what always happens, which is the grades to go down compared to exam one. But amphipathic refers to it literally means having dual preference. That's because the polar head prefers being around polar things, water included, and the tails prefer around being around other nonpolar things. That's why we use the words hydrophobic and hydrophilic. Hydrophilic, water-loving, refers to polar things. Hydrophobic, water-fearing, refers to nonpolar things. That explains how the first cells came into existence. Before they were alive, there were cell-like structures. Those formed simply when you had enough phospholipids accumulating in the environment, in the ocean, where life started, to form these little cell-like bags. But those are not alive, and a living cell cannot have it cannot have a plasma membrane made out of only phospholipids. And that's because a phospholipid bilayer is a boundary. Not everything gets blocked, but certain things do, namely things that don't want to be around these hydrophobic tails. Those kind of things don't easily pass through. And some of those things that don't easily pass directly through the phospholipid bilayer are things that a living cell has to allow to pass into or out of the cell, which is why a complete plasma membrane has a phospholipid substructure but also has other things in it as well to allow for passage of things that don't easily get through the phospholipid bilayer. That's what we see in slide 2. This is more than just phospholipids. You have the phospholipids there. That's what forms the substructure. But you have many different proteins embedded in here as well. And importantly, none of these molecules is covalently bonded to any of the other molecules. Each phospholipid in a phospholipid bilayer remains an entirely separate molecule. It's not connected to its neighbors. They're just in a crowd together. But they can switch positions, just like members of a crowd can. Similarly, the proteins that are part of the membrane are not connected to any of the phospholipids. And they can move around within the thickness of the membrane, within the layer of the membrane. But what keeps them there then? Well, a protein, remember what it is, a polypeptide, thinking back to the ribbon model, is a long sequence of amino acids, right? Each of which individually, each individual amino acid has an R group with chemical properties, right? There are different R groups, different R group categories. Some amino acids have R groups that are polar, has an R group that is polar. Other ones will have an R group that's nonpolar or charged. And that's what determines the shape that the ribbon folds up into, as we discussed, right? The overall three-dimensional shape of the polypeptide, the tertiary structure. And that's all here. You don't see the detail here in just this purple blob, but it is that there's a bunch of amino acids with individual R groups. Now, in this case, all of the amino acids in this region, in the central region of the overall protein, are nonpolar R groups. And they have no problem being around these similarly nonpolar tails. But the ones on the tips, both tips of the protein, those amino acids have R groups that are polar. They have no problem being around the polar heads. And that keeps them just centered within the thickness, but not connected covalently. They're not actually bonded. So they're like bobbers, kind of. If you were to push from the top of this figure, try to push this protein downward in the figure, it would resist doing that because this part, this tip of the protein that is polar, would then be exposed to these nonpolar tails, which it doesn't want to be exposed to, right? Plus all of these nonpolar R groups would be exposed to these polar heads, which they don't want to be. So as soon as you let go, it's going to spring right back to where it is. That's what holds it in place. But it's free to move around within the membrane because it's just a member of the crowd like the phospholipids themselves are. When we look at slide 3, we can see that a bilayer is really two layers. Each individual layer of phospholipids is called a monolayer. So there's an extracellular monolayer and a cytoplasmic monolayer. Cytoplasmic layer is in contact with the interior of the cell. And the extracellular one's obviously in contact with the extracellular fluid. But there's proteins that are part of the overall bilayer. However, if you use a technique called freeze fracturing, you freeze the overall bilayer so that you can then separate the two layers. What you see is that more of the proteins are associated with the cytoplasmic monolayer than are associated with the extracellular layer. And this makes sense because there's a lot going on inside the cell, right? And many of those proteins that are part of the membrane are directly interacting with things that are inside that cell. There's some that are interacting with things outside the cell as well. That's why you do have ones that are associated with the extracellular layer. But many more are associated with the cytoplasmic layer. Well, in slide 4, we can get back to what I was describing before, but I didn't give you the name of this. This fact that all of these constituents of the plasma membrane can move around, they're not bonded to each other, that is described by what is called the fluid mosaic model of membrane structure. And so why did we call it the fluid mosaic model? Well, what is a mosaic? Yeah, that's right. It's an art piece of artwork, so it's an image. But instead of using paint on some surface, you glue various items like pieces of glass or tile or whatever to a surface, each of which is like a little pixel of the overall image. That's a mosaic. And fluid refers to being able to flow, to change shape. A fluid in chemistry or in science is not another name for a liquid, by the way. Fluid and liquid are not interchangeable. A fluid is either a liquid or a gas, because both of those states can change shape, right? Whereas a solid maintains its shape. Things are locked in place. So that's what fluid means as an adjective, able to flow, able to change shape. And it's a fluid mosaic as opposed to one that's made by gluing things in place, because these individual tiles or pieces of glass or whatever are the individual phospholipids. They are changing places. We see an edge view here at the top, but imagine looking at it from the top downward onto the heads. That would be just like looking down on a crowd of people from a skyscraper. And they're close to each other, but they're not connected to each other, right? And if you looked at it over time, you know, like in Times Square, New Year's Eve or whatever, they would be changing places continuously, but staying on the same level. They're on the street. They're staying within that mono layer, but they're not connected to each other. That's the fluid mosaic model. And it might surprise you, looking at these numbers, just how often this shuffling around of the phospholipids occurs within a monolayer. About 10 million times per second in each of your cells. Just part of the fact that cells are highly dynamic. They're always changing, both internally and at the surface. It should make sense, though, that this is a fairly easy thing to do because they're not bonded to each other. Plus, if they are just staying within their own monolayer, it doesn't expose any nonpolar things to polar things, right? You still have the same relationship between tails. They're just moving around within the same monolayer. So it happens often. But much more rare is the so-called flip-flop that you see beside it. To do that, you have to exchange one phospholipid in one monolayer with a phospholipid in the other monolayer. And to do that, if you imagine flipping them around that way, that would temporarily, at least, while it's happening, expose the heads to this tail region, which puts polar by nonpolar. And that's what resists it. It does happen every once in a while, though, about once a month. In this second row, middle row, we see membrane fluidity being represented in cartoon form. So any membrane is a fluid mosaic, but there are degrees to fluidity. A membrane can be comparatively loose or comparatively tight. Well, it has to have the correct fluidity to remain alive. And that fluidity can be affected by the environment. For instance, if it gets really cold, everything's going to tighten up, right? Because things get more frozen-like. Therefore, to remain alive, a cell has to be able to adjust the fluidity, make it looser when it's tightening up to keep it normal fluidity. And it can do that by adjusting the kinds of phospholipids that are making up the membrane itself, which is always changing. If you think back to our discussion of triglycerides or fats, we talked about individual fatty acids, which are components of fats, and the fact that any individual fatty acid can be classified as either saturated or unsaturated based on whether or not there are double bonds between the carbons in that fatty acid. Remember all that? A saturated fatty acid is saturated with hydrogens, and that makes it a straight tail. Straight tails, saturated fatty acids packed together well. Well, the same applies to the fatty acids that are part of phospholipids. There's only two instead of three, but they're fatty acids still. And so fatty acids of phospholipids can be either saturated or unsaturated. Therefore, the entire phospholipid can be classified as either saturated or unsaturated. And if the membrane is getting too tight, then the cell can respond by taking out some saturated phospholipids and replacing them with unsaturated ones, that's going to loosen it up. Of course, it can also be a problem to be too loose, like when the temperature gets too warm. And then you'd want to do just the opposite. Take out the unsaturated phospholipids and replace them with saturated ones that are right next to each other and therefore tighter. The bottom shows you what happens, it shows you an animal plasma membrane. Why do we know this is an animal's? Because cholesterol is produced by animals, yes. There are other kinds of sterols that other organisms produce that I talked about, like phytosterols in plants and ergosterols in fungi. But in animals, cholesterol is besides all the other important jobs it does that I talked about, like being the precursor for all the steroid hormones and vitamin D, cholesterol also is an important component of the plasma membrane. It affects it fills in little gaps, as you can see here, so it affects the fluidity, but it also affects the permeability, whether things can get through it or not, as easy. Slide 5. I told you what the fluid mosaic model is, which is a hypothesis, and this slide shows you the results of a test to see whether the predictions that correspond to that hypothesis come true. In other words, this tests the fluid mosaic model. To do that, they used two individual species, a mouse and a human, a cell from each. Each of those cells, of course, is going to have various proteins embedded in its membrane, but they're going to be different kinds of proteins, mouse proteins and human proteins. And they used a technique to mark these. Didn't actually make them magenta and purple, but they chemically marked them so that they could keep track of where they are, the proteins, in both cases. And then they fused the two cells together into a hybrid cell. Now, at the very moment that it's fused, of course, all the mouse proteins are going to be on one end and all the human proteins are going to be at the other end of the hybrid cell. If the fluid mosaic model is not true, then you would expect that to just remain the same, right? You expect the proteins to stay in place, not fluid. But if it is true, then you would expect exactly what they actually saw to happen, which is after a little bit of time, it's a mixture of mouse and human proteins all over the surface of the cell because they're all switching places. Slide 6, another view, edge-on view of a plasma membrane, mostly phospholipids, as we've talked about. And there's all kinds of proteins shown in here, some extracellular proteins, some intracellular proteins. That's not the focus of this slide. We've already talked about the strain relief. But the focus of the slide are the proteins that are actually part of the membrane. And any protein that is part of a membrane is called a membrane-bound protein. So remember the distinction between the phrases membrane-bound and membrane-bounded. These are not enclosed by their own membrane. They are bound to or tied to the membrane itself. Therefore, they're part of the membrane. Well, this happens for many reasons that we'll look at in a minute. But just based on how a membrane-bound protein is bound to the membrane, there are two categories. And by bound to the membrane, once again, I don't mean covalently bonded. I just told you that they're not. But they're part of the membrane. There's two ways that can happen, though. One is that a membrane-bound protein can be just associated with or connected to having a relationship with just the heads of one monolayer. And those are called peripheral proteins. Now, this example is showing you peripheral proteins that are associated with the cytoplasmic monolayer, but you could also have ones out here. As long as they're only associated with polar heads, In other words, they don't stick into the thickness of the phospholipid bilayer. They're not associated with, they're not next to any tails. Those are called peripheral proteins because peripheral, the periphery is the edge of something. All right, they're still part of the membrane. They just don't go into the thickness. They're not associated with tails, phospholipid tails. The only other possibility is that a membrane-bound protein is associated with tails. In other words, does stick at least partway through the thickness of the membrane. Unfortunately, all of these other examples in this book's picture are ones that stick fully through the thickness. But that doesn't have to be the case. It's easy to imagine, though, any one of these ones sticking halfway through, for instance. Okay? So associated with tails, whether you go all the way through or not, is the other category. And that other category is called integral proteins because they are part of the integrity of that thickness. Integral proteins is any protein that's associated with the thickness, the tails. But there's a special case of integral proteins, which are all the ones shown here that are integral, and that is called transmembrane. If an integral protein sticks all the way through the thickness so that there is a part of that protein directly in contact with the extracellular fluid, and a part of that same protein directly in contact with the intracellular fluid, then it's not only integral, it's more specifically transmembrane. So it's just a special case of integral protein. Another thing you see on this, while we're still on this slide, is that on the extracellular surface, there are various sugars. All these green chains of hexagons are polypeptides. And some of them are connected to phospholipids, which makes the overall mixture, which is part sugar and part phospholipid, a glycolipid. Glyco means sugar. Others of these sugars are connected directly to proteins that are part of the membrane, so those are called glycoproteins, sugar and protein together. But these sugar or carbohydrate parts that are facing the exterior of the cell are operating more or less as little ID badges, telling the other cells that are still part of that same multicellular individual, I'm one of you. You know, only multicellular organisms have this problem, right? They're made up of multiple cells, and it's important for the individual cells that make up that individual to realize that they are part of the same individual. They're not foreigners. They're not potential enemies to be destroyed. So they have to be recognized, and that's what I mean by little ID tags. That brings us to 7, which uses a ribbon model once again to show you not only a membrane-bound protein and not only an integral protein, but a transmembrane protein, most specifically. Does this protein have quaternary structure? Well, what does it mean to have quaternary structure? Well, yeah, quaternary means fourth level of structure. Primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary. But what is that fourth level of structure? What is quaternary structure? Only certain kind of cell or certain kind of proteins have it. To have quaternary structure, a protein has to be made of 2 or more polypeptides. And this one doesn't. This is all one polypeptide. That's why a ribbon is used, right? There's just two ends to this. It coils up many times and it wraps back and forth through the thickness, but it's all one polypeptide. So it only has primary, secondary, and tertiary structure. But notice all of these alpha helices, which is part of secondary structure, remember. There's many different alpha helices, and each one is kind of like the wooden staves of a barrel that are put all together to make up the wall of the barrel. And the barrel itself has a hollow interior. This hollow interior is why this protein exists. This is a protein that's not only a membrane-bound protein, but specifically has the job of acting as a transport protein. This is what I was talking about when I said you can't have a plasma membrane made out of only phospholipids, because some of the things that can't easily get through the phospholipid bilayer need to be able to get into or out of the cell. And they do that through various kinds of transport proteins. Well, that's just one of six major functions, transporting. In slide 8, we see the six major categories of functions that membrane-bound proteins have. Transport is listed first, and that's what we just saw an example of. I'll talk more about transport proteins in a little bit, but any time that you have a particle that can't easily get through a membrane, I mean get through the phospholipid bilayer, then you're going to need a transport protein to allow it to pass through the membrane. That can happen in different ways, so there are different classifications of them, but they're all transport proteins. Another job that membrane-bound proteins can have is working as enzymes. What is every enzyme an example of? A catalyst, exactly. Enzymes are proteins acting as catalysts. And a catalyst is a substance that speeds up a chemical reaction without being a reactant in that reaction. It just interacts with the reactants in such a way that it causes them to get turned into products much faster than would happen without the help of the catalyst. Well, you have many, many enzymes, thousands of different enzymes, because you have thousands of different kinds of chemical reactions occurring, and each chemical reaction needs its own specific kind of enzyme to speed it up, or you'll not be able to remain alive. That's why a big part of your genome, a big fraction of your overall genes, is dedicated to serving as instructions for how to specifically make enzymes, most of which are operating within the cell, inside the cell, speeding up reactions that are occurring in the cytosol or in organelles. But some of the enzymes just happen to also be part of the membrane. It doesn't really change anything about how an enzyme works. It's still doing the same thing that any enzyme does. It has an active site on it that allows for a certain substrate to bind, which gets turned into a product. That can happen either entirely inside the cell or as part of a membrane-bound protein. Signal transduction is next. And transduction is the noun form of the verb transduce, which means to convert from one form to another. A loudspeaker is a good example of a transducer because it converts an AC electrical signal, which is coming through the speaker cable, into magnetically driven movement of the cone, which pushes on the air and you eventually sense it as sound. So there's a conversion there. Well, we have in cells what is called signal transduction involving chemical signals. I've already talked about chemical signals, and I've told you that a chemical signal is something that causes things to happen in the cell that wouldn't happen without that chemical signal present. But I also told you that no chemical signal can have any effect unless and until it binds to a receptor protein that has just the right shape to receive it. Well, hormones are good examples of signal molecules. And chemically speaking, there's two broad categories of hormones. Those are ones that are amino acid based, the so-called protein hormones. And you also have ones that are lipid based, like all of the steroid hormones that come from a lipid known as cholesterol, right? All of those are lipid hormones. Well, lipids are nonpolar. So they have their receptors inside cells, because a nonpolar thing can easily slip through the phospholipid bilayer. It doesn't mind being around those nonpolar tails. All right? So that's where the receptors are, inside the cell. But the majority of hormones are protein hormones, which are too big to get inside of cells. And they therefore have to have their receptors on the surface of cells, since they can't get in. They more or less knock on the door rather than entering the room. Just like this sector-shaped orange signal molecule, whatever it is, its receptor is on the surface of the cell. It's a membrane-bound receptor protein. And what did I tell you is the general consequence of any ligand, including signals, binding to a protein? When a ligand binds to a protein, what happens? Right, there is a conformational change in the protein. The protein changes shape. Okay, well, imagine, even though it's not pictured, that this receptor protein is an integral protein, but not transmembrane. So it just goes halfway through the outer thickness. If the signal molecule comes along and binds to the receptor will change shape. But the inside of the cell won't know that's happening, right? Just something on the surface is changing shape. Big deal. So a membrane-bound protein that's acting as a receptor needs to be a transmembrane protein. That way, when you have the signal binding to the exterior part of the membrane, of the protein, that protein changes shape in such a way that even the interior-facing part of the protein changes shape, and that allows it to interact differently with things inside the cell, like this purple thing that now fits the shape since the shape has changed. Well, the original signal's job is done. It delivered a message only so far, and it's like giving a note to someone else. This new signal is called the second messenger. It's inside the cell. The original cell doesn't enter the cell, but the message is transduced into the form of a different messenger, a different signal. D is cell-to-cell recognition. I was mentioning this before when I talked about the little ID badges. So this applies to multicellular organisms. You have two different proteins involved here. One is a glycoprotein embedded in the membrane of one cell, and the other is a protein embedded in the membrane of another cell, but it has just the right shape to recognize this particular sugar, and therefore it says, okay, I'm not going to kill you, you're one of us. Intercellular joining is similar, using two different proteins in two different cells interacting, but in this case not for recognition, instead for keeping the cells together. This is exactly what a desmosome is that I just showed you for animals. And then also similar is attachment to the cytoskeleton and extracellular matrix simultaneously. I've already talked about this. This was the strain relief I was talking about. This membrane-bound protein is transmitting the force of pulling, for instance, through itself and then to the cytoskeleton, preventing the membrane from ripping and also preventing the protein itself from being taken out of the membrane. Brings us to 9. Very similar picture to one we saw in the tour of the cell, where we've talked about this movement around of membrane in the form of vesicles between organelles. We already talked about the fact that the rough endoplasmic reticulum packages vesicles after it has modified proteins, puts those proteins in vesicles, which then get received by the Golgi, and the Golgi figures out where they need to go. I've already told you all about that. The Golgi figures out whether the proteins need to be fully exported out of the cell or put into the plasma membrane. I just didn't have as good a picture to show you how the difference is made between those two scenarios. Here you have a vesicle budding off of the Golgi, and it contains different proteins. Some of those proteins are completely inside the vesicle. Others, well, just one is shown here, this dumbbell-shaped one, is not completely in the vesicle. It's part of the membrane of the vesicle because of the way the Golgi packaged it. Okay? Now, when this vesicle finally makes it to the surface of the plasma membrane and fuses into it, because all membrane material is the same, the proteins that were completely inside the vesicle get spilled all the way out of the cell. That's exportation. But the dumbbell one that is part of the membrane of the vesicle now just becomes part of the plasma membrane. This is how cells can put things into the plasma membrane, or the reverse process. Make a vesicle by taking it upward can take things out of the plasma membrane. Membrane material is continuously being moved around, and proteins with it, because proteins are part of membranes. Okay, now, we've already talked about 10, 11, and 12, right? So I just want to remind you that 10, 11, and 12, I'm not going to talk about again, but they have their own recording, and they are part of the material for the lecture examination. But we can quickly go past those to 13, where we have a picture of a protist. Now, the word protist has been used in different ways throughout the ages. But protist does not necessarily refer to a unicellular organism. Nowadays, what protist means is any eukaryote that is not an animal, a plant, or a fungus. Animals, plants, and fungi are all eukaryotic, but they're not the only eukaryotes. There are algae and various other kinds of eukaryotes. Anyway, anything that is in that eukarya domain but not within animal, plant, or fungus kingdom is collectively called the protists. Some are unicellular, as this one is, but some are multicellular. There are some brown algae, for instance, that are the size of trees. Anyway, this is more specifically a unicellular protist, and even more specifically in terms of its lifestyle, it is an aquatic protist. Now, what does aquatic mean? It means living in water, but so does marine. What is the difference between the terms? What are the two types of water?
Salt or fresh.
Right. Aquatic is freshwater, or the word freshwater is even better, because aquatic literally could mean either. But it's usually used to mean freshwater. And marine is saltwater. So rivers, lakes, and streams, aquatic. Oceans, gulfs, things like that, marine. And those are totally different lifestyles when you think about tonicity, right? If you are an aquatic organism like this thing is, then what kind of environment do you live in terms of tonicity? No. It's not isotonic because inside the cell is not as watery as a lake or a river is.
Hypotonic?
Right. Hypotonic means more watery than the cell. Well, this thing lives in a very watery environment, which means osmosis is going to tend to happen continuously. In which direction? Into the cell, right? Water is going to continuously be coming into this single cell. Well, just like our own cells, this happens to be a cell that does not have a cell wall. It has just that flimsy plasma membrane, no cell wall in addition to that. And therefore, what happens in the face of hypotonicity? swelling, right? That would burst our own cells, as we talked about. Well, you can lose a million cells without even knowing. It's happening all the time. I mean, you lose billions of cells every day. You make billions new ones to replace them. But if you are a unicellular organism and you lose one cell, that's the end of your life. So it's a big deal. And this hypotonicity would kill it if it weren't for this specialized organelle called a contractile vacuole, which is a vacuole. It's a little sac made out of membrane, but it also has microfilaments associated with it, the same things that allow our muscles to work, so that when enough water coming in from osmosis swells the vacuole enough, it will cause it to contract, to squeeze itself, expelling the water out one bead at a time. So it acts like a little bilge pump, continuously pumping the water out. It can't do anything about the fact that water's coming in, but it can avoid death by lysis. Okay, 14. Now let's look more closely at the transport function of membrane-bound proteins. So let's talk about transport proteins in greater detail. Transport proteins, as I said, are required because there are certain things that don't pass easily directly through the phospholipid bilayer. So let's first talk about that. There are two reasons that a given particle might not be able to pass easily directly through the phospholipid bilayer. One is that it's too big. If a particle is simply too big, like a protein hormone I was talking about earlier, it's just not going to get through easily. Another possibility, though, is that it's too polar, either polar or beyond polar, which would be fully charged, like an ion. Well, speaking of ions, what is the smallest ion? Hydrogen ion, otherwise known as what? Well, I wouldn't call it a trick question.
I thought it was a trick question.
No. Oh, the one you already got right?
Correct.
No, but what's the answer to the second question? What is a hydrogen ion otherwise known as? I told you that you should, in your brain, equate three different things that mean exactly the same thing. H plus, hydrogen ion, and what? Okay, well, let's start with a hydrogen atom. What do you have making up a hydrogen atom?
One proton?
No. Not just one proton. I'm talking about an atom.
One proton, one electron.
Okay, that's a hydrogen atom. To ionize, you lose that electron. And therefore, what is another name for a hydrogen ion? Start with a proton and electron, you lose an electron. Don't overthink this. If I have a proton and an electron and I take away the electron, what do I have? A proton, yes. That's what a hydrogen ion is, a proton. By far smaller than any other ion, and smaller than other atoms, right? So it's plenty small enough to get through the membrane, but it still doesn't get through, directly through the phospholipid bilayer, but it still can't get through easily because it is fully charged, right? It's an ion. It does not want to be around these nonpolar tails. So it's kept on one side of the membrane or the other, whichever one it's on. Okay, so those are the two things. A particle can be either too big, too charged, or polar, or both. It can be big and polar. Any one of those will prevent it from easily passing directly through the phospholipid bilayer, and that's why we need transport proteins to allow those kinds of particles through the membrane, either into or out of the cell. Well, based on how a transport protein allows that to happen, there are two major categories of transport proteins, shown here. In the top, we have a cutaway view because you wouldn't see the interior of this normally if the front were in place. But it's cutaway to show you that this category really is just a little tunnel. That's called a channel protein. That one with all the alpha helices was a channel protein earlier. And the tunnel, now it can have gates on the end which could open and close. Some of them do, some of them don't have gates. But anyway, the tunnel itself, not the gates, which don't even have to be there, the tunnel itself does not change shape. And therefore, if a particle is present that happens to be the right kind of particle, small enough and of the right type, then it will easily be able to go through the tunnel, the channel protein. Channel proteins, in other words, operate by maintaining, not by changing their shape. They keep their shape. On the other hand, some transport proteins do change conformation in order to allow for the passage of the particle. Those are called carrier proteins because there is a temporary binding of the particle, whatever it is, to the carrier protein, and that's another example of a ligand binding to a protein, right? The particle being transported through the membrane is a ligand in this case. And therefore, the general consequence is a change in shape of the protein itself. So in this particular example, you have the original shape, which is such that there's a gap facing outwards. That allows for the solute particle to bind. That binding event changes the shape in such a way that now it's open to the inside of the cell and it lets loose of that solute particle. Now it's inside the cell. Now that could happen in exactly the reverse direction. It doesn't have to operate to bring things in. It just depends on the particular protein. But the point is, any given carrier protein operates by changing shape, by changing its conformation during the transport process. That's a good place to stop since we're out of time.